So we were going through how we're going through Lamrim, steps of the Lamrim, and I thought it was good if we talked about. It's good to learn Lamrim from a book, and it's also good just to be with a Lama who's doing Lamrim, and then you learn it by osmosis, which is really the best way to learn things, right? So just by being around a Lama, you learn the Lamrim by how they act, right? And so I was going through things that I remembered about Ken Rinpoche's practice of the Lamrim. While we lived together for 20 years, so I had a chance to watch him and you know, see how he was practicing Lamrim, right? So then I thought somebody should take these out of this class and make them into a little thing. I don't know, eventually. So think about that. Like just little short things. Not the whole thing, but just the little beautiful things. Like a book of Lamrim based on... See, this Lamrim is unusual, Delam, because it's all meditation. And then there are other Lamrims which are more technical, like Lamrim Chemul. But to have a Lamrim where that was just a book of actual actions undertaken by a great Lama, which demonstrate the Lamrim, would be an interesting Lamrim. I don't think anyone's done that in that way before. So anyway, think about that. So I'll keep going for this term and next term. Just before Khyabjai Tichen Rinpoche passed, which is 1981, he lived for 81 years, which is what Lord Buddha lived for. And lamas tend to pass around 81, 82, 83. And so Khyabjai Tichen Rinpoche, just before he passed, Ken Rinpoche and Art met him. And I never met Khyabjai Tichen Rinpoche. I lived next door to him for 6 months. And I never went next door. In Dharamsala, when I was first there. Because I didn't want to bother him. And students from the library would go meet him, you know, like once or twice a week. And I would say, he's too big, you know, like, I'm not worthy and to take his time, you know. So then Rinpoche once asked me, you know, did you meet Khyabjai Tichen Rinpoche? I said, no, I didn't want to bother him. He said, that was really stupid, you know. But anyway, they went, and Khyabjai Tichen Rinpoche said, it was a nice relationship because Rinpoche told me, he did his prostrations, and then the first thing Khyabjai Tichen Rinpoche said was, getting a little thin up top, aren't we? You know? and then during the course of the conversation, Khyabjai Tichen Rinpoche said, well, now you're in America, right? And Rinpoche said, yes. And so he said, well, you know, there's this book which people call Liberation in the Palm of Your Hands. It's really a gift of liberation thrust into the palm of your hands. And I prefer that. It's Lak Chang Su Tepa, which means jammed into your hand, you know. There it is. Take it, you know. And in the palm of your hands, kind of, in English, means it's your problem or it's your response. It's in your hands. And it's not the feeling of the title. The title is, the Lama is coming and just jamming this gift into your hand. Take it, you know. But anyway, pet peeve of mine. So this book is a record of teachings by Pabongka Rinpoche over like 25 days or something like that. It's a Lamrim, very famous. And Ken Rinpoche taught it all the way through many times. And Tichen Rinpoche took the notes. And Tichen Rinpoche wrote the Lamrim. And it took him like, I don't know, 15, 20 years or something. But he did it perfect. Like, if you can read Tibetan, that book is absolutely exquisite Tibetan, like perfect, like he worked and worked and worked. So it's really a transcript. That book is a transcript, and I think it's the greatest book ever written. Maybe it's just perfect in meaning. It's perfectly accurate. Everything is beautiful, and the Tibetan is like the best Tibetan ever. It's everything is exquisite. So that was like a labor of love by Khyabjai Tichen Rinpoche, right? He wrote books. He has a sungbum. We have it, but the most famous thing he ever did was to execute the Lamrim of his teacher, and it's just incredible, you know. So Anyway, TJ Rinpoche is standing, sitting there, and he's talking to Ken Rinpoche, and he says, America, like they talk English there, right? Yeah, yeah. Well, I want you to translate liberation in the palm of your hand, okay? For me. All right? And Rinpoche says, yes, of course. Whatever you tell me. And Rinpoche's English was really rudimentary at that point, right? And so he came back, and we're talking, and he's like, I got to learn English really well. You know, we have to translate this book, you know. And then to learn English, he had gone to, when I first met him, my first job was to drive him down to Washington, D.C. Someone had paid for him to take an English course at Georgetown University for six months or 4 months or something. So we went down there. He stayed in the Sri Lankan monastery there, Vihara. And they didn't have room for me. I stayed across the street in a Zen monastery. And then every day we went, I drove him to Georgetown, and he took English lessons. But he had to do this in order to translate, right, in order to teach. And at the same time, he had never been to a dentist. Okay, this is 1975. And he's 54 already, right? He's never seen a dentist before. And so he had to have like 17 teeth pulled out. And we had a really good dentist who said, he was black, he was in Georgetown, he was in that area, and he said, this man is a preacher. So the other dentist wanted to pull out all of his teeth. And this dentist said, no, we'll leave part of his teeth, as many as we can save, and then we'll build his teeth, you know. And so they did, and it took like months, you know, and it was really painful. But he would have teeth taken out, and in the same day he would teach every Saturday in the Vihara. And Bob Taylor was there, and people like that. Peg Brenner was there, and people like that were already there in 75. So anyway, so he's like, we take him to the Georgetown. He jumps out of the car. He runs. There's like all these 20-year-olds, right, in this class. And then he's in his robes, and he goes into the class, and he's like almost 60, right? He's the 50-something. And he says, I got to learn English, you know. Chidori Rinpoche told me, my lama told me. So I have to do it, you know. And he's like, I'll do it, you know. And who can learn a foreign language when they're, you know, almost 60, you know. And English is a terrible language. So he went to school, and he was like, determined to learn. And then he came home the first night, and he said, I got this stuff. It's called homework, you know. And he says, and he's like, you do it. You know? Like, he just hands me all the homework. He says, you do it, you know. And I'm like, Rinpoche, the point is that you have to do it, you know. And he just looks at me like that. And I'll never forget this. He looks at me and he says, I'm your teacher, you know. And in those days, he was very, very fresh out of Tibet. He was very, he hadn't been Americanized yet, you know. No, and he was like wrathful a lot. And he's like, are you kidding? You're going to refuse your lama? You know, he said, I told you, do my homework. Do it, you know. And it was very much that for the first 10 years or so. You know, it was like, I'm your lama. What are you thinking? You know, I asked you to do something. What are you talking back to me? What are you saying? You know, and it was just unthinkable to him. You know, like he just said, I'm your lama, and he just shoved it in my hand. You know, and that was it. So anyway, but slowly he started doing homework. And then he really worked hard on his English. Like people don't know. Like he after every class in Howell. And he would teach sometimes 2-3 classes a day in Howell. And nobody would come, right? So it bugs me, you know. When a lama gets old, when a lama passes, everyone rushes there and prays for them. Please come back, you know. But then when he's there, nobody comes to class, you know. Or nobody works on this stuff. And that went on for 10, 20 years, you know. And 5 people, 3 people, 2 people, 1 person, you know. So I don't go much in for the big ceremonies that when they get old or when they pass, you know, I'm not into that. When they're there, when they're strong, vital, teaching you the Lam Rim, you know, come to class. You know, when they get old, pass, then you already, things are set. You don't have to worry anymore. Nobody has to worry. They don't have to worry. You don't have to worry. So anyway, so after class, I would go into his room and I'd have a whole list of what he said wrong. You know, like this book wrote Tsongkhapa, which went on for years. Subjects and objects. And then like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he would claim that his English was really bad. But then sometimes he would take off onto like 2-hour exquisite, flowery, perfect English, you know? And then you got this weird feeling that he was just humoring you. And that he wanted you to listen carefully to what he was saying. And that he wanted you to have the virtue of working on his books and stuff like that. And that he could have just as well written them in much better English than you could. Like you got this strong sense sometimes. And I'm sure His Holiness's translators have the same experience, you know, like it's kind of frustrating to translate for His Holiness. But anyway, so he really worked hard. And at one point I remember we heard that the same book was being translated by Wisdom Publications in London. And I was going to be going to see De Beers. Because I was translating Russian for De Beers, secretly. Because the Russians had developed real artificial diamonds, like genuine diamond in a lab. And it was a state secret. And you could be executed a Russian could be executed for giving out information about it. So we were trying to translate transmissions and things like that. And so I was invited to London to meet De Beers. And so I said, I'll go see if this translation is any good or how far along they are. And I went and I met Nick Ribush, who was in charge of Wisdom at the time. And he said, here it is, you know, it's just about done. And I looked it through and it was okay. It's, you know, it wasn't the level that art could do or Ken Rinpoche would do, but it was okay. So I came back and I said, Rinpoche, you know, they're almost done. And given that there's 200,000 books to translate, maybe we should work on a different one. You know, and he said, he just looked at me like, are you crazy? Chichar Rinpoche told me to do this, you know. And I said, but it's going to take like 10, 20 years, you know. You know, he just looked at me like, are you insane? You know, Chichar Rinpoche told me to do this. You know, it doesn't matter what else, you know. So he worked for that for 20 years he worked on that. And to fulfill his lama's wishes. So 20 years after he was asked to do it, he finished it. But he didn't give up and he didn't stop. And down to our right, which is our next subject, you know, your opportunities, working with what you have. Leveraging what you have, your intelligence, your physical health, your finances, leveraging it into Dharma work, right? He was so good at that. He didn't know a word of English when he got to America, you know, and he's already pushing, he's getting on 60, right? And but his Lama told him. So he did it, you know. 20 years it took. And he just kept plugging away at it. And he finished it, you know. The other thing like that is that I think it was on the same trip in 1981. He met His Holiness in his quarters in Dharamsala. And His Holiness said, do you know there's some monks from Sera down in South India trying to start Sera again? You know, and Rinpoche's like, well, I heard some stuff, but I don't. Actually, his brother had been a government official in South India and had found the land for Sera. So I heard to my brother something, you know, who passed away later in an accident, car accident. I heard something about that. And so Dalai Lama leans over and says, you are going down to help. You know, and Rinpoche's like, whatever you say, you know, it wasn't in my plans, but I'll go. And he canceled his ticket. He went down to South India. Art went with him. And at the time, the monks were living in tents. I mean, those of you who've been to Sera, that was a jungle. There were wild elephants there. And the monks, some monks were hurt by the elephants trying to protect the first fields they planted. And it was a very wild place. And so they just by hand started pulling out trees and clearing the land. And they were living in tents and there was no water. There's one dirty stream. Like I was there during those days. There was no wells. There was no fresh water. Just this muddy, dirty stuff. It was all brown. It looked like almost like Coke. And that's all you had to drink. And everyone was getting sick all the time. And there was lice everywhere. And everyone had these big, huge, open sores from malnutrition. And there were flies in them. Everybody had these everybody was sick. Everybody had, like, TB. And so went down there and looked around and said, are you guys, it was 100 guys survived out of, like, 8,000? Okay, 108 guys made it to South India from Sera. And they started the monastery again. So Rinpoche went down there, and I remember Ard came back and said, I will never go to India again. And he never did. But Rinpoche said, we have to do it, you know, we have to do it. So we started, like, with, we sponsored 5 monks, their expenses. And you know the story. So he spent 20 years with nothing. He came to America with nothing. He couldn't speak a word of English. He didn't have a dollar, right? And he would not charge for class, right? So how's this guy going to help Sarah, you know? And he would not bother his students, right? So he just, people gave him $5. He would set it aside. He got, after he retired, he got Social Security. He would never take that money. He always put it aside for Sarah, right? So he would, like, get this check from Social Security, and he'd put it on his altar, you know? And it would be there for, like, a week, and then he would put it aside for Sarah. And then it would drive me crazy. I'm the cook, right? And we'd go to the grocery store, and he wouldn't go unless he had those, what do you call those? Coupons, right? Like, we don't go to a store unless we got coupons. You know, and I'm like, Rinpoche, you're going to save, like, 3 cents, you know? And he says, it's for Sarah. You know, we have to save the money. He never spent money on himself. Nothing. You know, nothing. Never, ever for himself. And he would, like, take the $5, and he would buy, like, some cruddy old bread from the three-day, you know, what do you call it? Thrift, you know, like, old bread corner in the store. And then we would eat that, and then he would save the money. So he built up this money. Now that fund, you know, it's a success story, right? 25 years later, it feeds about 2,000 monks every day. Okay, and he just did what his lama asked him to do. You see what I mean? So the thing is, like, even after the lama would pass, right, for 20 years, he's still there trying to do what his lama told him to do. You see, it's like unbelievable. And he built most of the buildings at Sera. He paid for them. They were bankrupt. They were on the verge of bankruptcy in about 1983 or something like that. They were ready to close the monastery. And the temple was owned by other people. The main temple had been mortgaged, and they had defaulted. And so the main temple was going to be lost to just some local people. And so Rinpoche organized 3 people, gave up all their money, every penny they had. And he unmortgaged it. And so that, you know, he kept doing stuff like that. And even up to the last year, when he went the last year to Sera, he presented them, I think, with $100,000+ that people had donated to keep the food fund going. Okay, so he just struggled like that. I remember one day someone gave him $10,000. He just took it. He flew to Sera. We went to Sera. We sat down. We opened the door of the scholarship office, and we said, any monk who has a medical need, just come. And there, this is a line of like 500 guys. And anyone that had a receipt from a pharmacy or a doctor would just get reimbursed. And we spent the whole day, from morning up to night, each person, he sat down with each person, he reviewed their case, he got all the receipts in, you know, if you don't have a receipt, you don't get any money. And then he reimbursed each monk for their medical expense. And he spent $10,000 in one day. And they just flew back to the United States, you know. And so, you know, just that determination with his with his language, right, to learn, because his lama, he has to learn this to execute his lama's wishes. And then 20 years of dogged determination to finish the thing, right? And then with what His Holiness just said it off the top of his head, right? Go down and help them. It's like takes 1 minute to say that. And for 20 years, he worked on it, you know, and he made sure that they were taken care of, you know. So that's how his guru yoga, right? That was how his, how he fought that you should behave towards your lama, right?